summoned through the dimension of sound. People explore the musical world, which they believe to be true. But there is a world, unheard by some, that is filled with stories of an unknown reality, a jazz side.
My guest today is singer-songwriter, musician, visual artist, Samantha Molly Lou Cernaca, or AKA Simi Stone.
Yes, that's easier.
Hello, Simi.
Hello, Veronica.
Thank you. I appreciate you doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great. I don't think I've ever asked you how you came to Simi Stone. Was it something you just kind of thought up, or?
No, it's actually something that was almost a joke. When I was on tour with the band I was in called The Duke and the King, we had like a meteoric rise to fame, short and sweet and fizzled out fast. But it was we were touring England and we were getting very popular each show. And Bobby Bird, who was my drummer at the time in the band, we all sang and he played drums. And one night we really went to town on the end of, like, I think a Neil Young cover, and I was just like singing and moving and shaking my butt and doing the whole thing. And afterwards, right, he was like, "You're like Simi Stone," like the Stones, you know, like,
oh,
being like Simi Stones.
Yeah.
You know, like he was calling me that. So then they were all just nicknaming me, like kidding around, Simi Stone all week. And then we got to London and a reporter from the London, you know, Daily or The Guardian or some big magazine or paper was interviewing us. Mm-hmm. We were in the van, like driving into the city, and Simon Felice, who was in the band, was like, who are you? Like, what, they want to know everyone's name.
Right.
So, Samantha, are you Samantha? Are you Simi? What? Simi Sunshine? Simi Stone? Like, and I was like, and Bird was like, Simi Stone. So whatever was happening. And I just said, I'm Simi Stone. Yeah, Simi Stone. Just,
wow.
In just thinking it was whatever, just going to be a write-up and something. Mm-hmm. And the editorial was so cool, and they said, because Noel Haskins, our friend Noel, he was from Jersey, but he was a Deacon, he played drums. Bobby Bird played bass and sometimes drums, but Noel was a drummer, sorry. And so they were like, Stone and Haskins, holding it down or whatever, because we had sang majority of the harmonies, and it just sounded so good, and then it just became Simi Stone, because it was almost, had a life of its own from that. And then we came back to America and we were doing really well, and we actually signed a record deal, but then everything just fell apart for reasons I won't get into.
Okay. Yeah, we don't have to do that.
I can't talk about it, but it was out of my control, which is very frustrating. But I realized, you know, the name that I had was, I had made a name for myself
using that
name as a violinist
name?
And a singer in that group somehow.
Okay.
And I went to a show on New Year's Eve with my friend a while ago, like I think in, you know, whenever this was, like in 2012 or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And someone came up to me and said, "Are you Simi Stone?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And they were like, "Oh my God," and freaked out and had a picture with me. And I went because I had gone with my ex-boyfriend from college, because he's like, we're close, you know, and we were really close then, just always stayed friends. And he was like, "Wow, you're Simi Stone now." And I was like, "Oh my God, I am." So I just went with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And wow. So, yeah, so even though the band broke up, I still did tour with Simon a lot, but I was Simi Stone because a lot of the touring we did was in England and the UK, and that's where a lot of my, I kind of got a lot of some credibility there.
Mm-hmm.
after my punk band, that punk band period.
Okay. And we're going to talk about that too. Okay. But, you know, first of all, I know a lot of times people who listen to the show want to know, like, well, how do I know the people that I interview? And I just wanted people to know that you and I, we have some incredible connections.
Yes.
We're both practitioners of Nichiren Buddhism.
Yes. Right?
So we chant Nam-myoho-renge-kyo. Yeah. And actually, that's kind of how we met. We met through the practice first. And so we both live in Woodstock.
Yes, we do.
Okay. Yeah. And, of course, there's that musical component. Mm-hmm. You're also a visual artist. And we're going to actually talk about that a little bit later. But right now, I want to start where we are, which is physically, we're right here in Woodstock. So I think you were telling me you were born in Woodstock, but what I kind of wanted some insight on was, you know, what was it like to grow up in Woodstock? Because that was about 10 years. You were born about 10 years after the festival, which was in 69.
Yeah.
So I didn't mean to give your
That's
age
okay.
away.
That's okay. There's all different. I'm all different ages.
Oh, okay, great. Because I wasn't sure.
No, but that's accurate.
Oh, okay. Because I looked it up and there was a lot of different ages. So I'm just going to say. Yeah. You have the wisdom of ages, though.
Yeah.
But what is that? What was that like in the scene growing up here and just because everything was connected to Woodstock, you know, for the festival and then to be actually growing up here.
Definitely. It was all in, you know, it was part of the fabric of our lives. It was the backdrop, you know, the festival was kind of the backdrop. Music was the backdrop, you know, Bob Dylan, Jimi Hendrix, like all these people were part of, literally there were posters everywhere of them and t-shirts. And, you know, we grew up with the band would be playing at the watering trough at the pool down the street, you know, on the weekends.
Wow.
You know, at least some of the band. I mean, I think Robbie Robertson at that point, maybe. I mean, as looking back, I know, that was the band. But when I was a kid, it was like, oh, Rick Danko and Levon, whatever, those guys there, they're playing down the road. I didn't realize who, it was almost as though I lived in this magical place, and we knew we lived in a magical place because it was beautiful, and it was, we were kind of free. It was wild, believe me, it was a wild scene, because our parents were, you know, of that hippie generation, and very open-minded, and, you know, we walked around barefoot, went to shows all the time, you know. Music was such, it was like just part of everyone's soul. Like, it was just part of us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we always, whenever the bands would come up, so we saw a lot of live music as kids, too. There were festivals all the time. That we were really into reggae, and we loved Bob Marley, and, you know, everyone who came to town, we'd always go to the shows. We couldn't, like, there would be festivals at the rec field in town, which was this big field.
So where is the, because I'm...
The rec field is by the colony. It's on the same road.
Oh, I know where that is.
The cemetery is and then the rec field.
They call it Andrew or something field.
Yeah, it's... Not Cantine. That's in Saugerties.
Well, whatever.
I
should know it too, because everybody references it when they're going to do some kind of festival type of thing, and I can't remember the name of it. But
I know the name of it, but I can't remember in this moment, because there was Rick Volt's Field, which is in my neighborhood, which is in the Bearsville Flats. But yeah, so it was very much, you know, music and art and being an artist and. It was kind of a normal thing to do here.
Mm.
So it wasn't a place where if you said you were going to be an artist or a musician, that your parents were mortified.
Oh, right. It's like the establishment, man.
I mean, there was a lot of singing and a lot of theater classes. And, you know, I was in theater classes and improv groups all growing up. I went to the New York Conservatory for the Arts. So that was like an upstate. And so we used to dance, you know, music was just part of us. And all the bands that would come and record in Woodstock during the late 80s and 90s, we would go and they would always do shows in town, like wow. in Living Color, and mm-hmm. I think even the Stones, and like all these bands.
Wow.
So we were exposed to rock stardom.
Yeah.
Early.
Yeah. So was that kind of like when you started, I was reading that you started playing classical violin and studying ballet, but the classical violin, 7 years of age, what was that, because of the scene, or was it anything in particular that you saw and said, oh, I want to play that instrument?
Well, as I remember it, my sister played violin.
Oh, okay.
And they had a big music program in the Woodstock Elementary School. You know, oh. when you were in second grade, you played the flute.
Okay.
Or the recorder.
Yeah, yeah, the recorder.
Everyone did.
Right. Yeah.
That's... And if they felt like you liked music, they would ask you, do you want to be in the band or the orchestra?
Oh, okay.
And we're making these decisions like when we're in second grade. Like, yeah, I would like to. Like, you go home. Like, I don't even know. Did they tell us to go home and tell our mom that we should ask? Or were they like you? But I think a lot of people were asked. Mm-hmm. But I was so... Violin was like in the periphery of my life because my sister was always recording. And when I was young, we shared a room. She was old. She's 8 years older than me.
Oh, okay.
And of course, I looked up to her. And our neighbor was Betty McDonald, who was a well-known jazz violinist in Woodstock. So she was like my aunt, basically. So I saw her playing violin, and it was very much in my life. And after the year that I played the recorder, or I can't remember if it was the summer before or summer after, but she taught me how to play Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star on the violin.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was kind of like, oh, this is fun. I can remember like sitting out in our like yard in the lawn mm-hmm. and like playing, and she was teaching me. And I remember liking it, but I wanted to play the clarinet.
Oh.
Because I had played the recorder, and I was like, this is the jam, the recorder. So they offered me, but you had to have a second choice, and my second choice was violin, because I was like, well, I guess I'll pick it, because I already know it. In my head, I'm like, I already know how to play it, my sister plays it, whatever. Yeah. But so they gave me violin, and I was a little bit disappointed, because I wanted to play the
the clarinet.
Yeah, but I was like, well, okay. And I remember they gave me my violin. I'm sure it was like so small.
Because they had to fit your little hands.
Yeah, you had the little tiny ones. So I was like 8 years old, and I was in orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
So and they had chorus and orchestra, and, you know, they had always, you know, there was always performing and everything. And I just picked it up, and I just loved it. Like, I remember, like, I'm sure I tortured my mother with my horrible practicing, but I feel like I always kind of knew what I was doing somehow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I, you know, and a lot of people drop it once they get to seventh grade, you know, and eighth grade. And then in high school, you don't, you know, the people playing in orchestra are not cool.
Right.
Know?
So did you stop playing
never
a
gave
little
it
bit?
Up.
Oh, you never gave it up?
No, because I loved it. I loved violin.
Wow.
And I loved it. And I just kept with it, I was a performer young, and my mom kind of knew that, like beyond like the normal everybody taking theater class, like I had something and I wanted to do it, you know?
Yeah.
So she signed me up for ballet in Kingston and was like, would drive me to like dance class mm-hmm. after school. It was like that kind of thing.
Yeah, so that's how that came.
That came about, My mom was amazing.
Yeah. She
was
I met
like,
her.
Oh, okay, you She's have amazing. Something, so I'm gonna, we're gonna, you're gonna, and I, you know, I couldn't play and hang out like everyone because I had to go. I went to dance class mm-hmm. or I went to theater class
mm-hmm.
and acting and dance and singing, and so I kind of really got. Then I got into musical theater.
Okay.
And jazz dance. I mean, like modern jazz dance and more like that kind of dancing, like from Broadway.
Right. And I was reading somewhere that you would set up performing on playgrounds, on your playground.
I would play on the playground. Yeah.
Concerts.
My friend Tara, yes, I did. Tara Orslich and I, we wrote a song in fourth grade.
Wow.
And we would, ever at the playground, we would perform it. Like we'd have a show and we would do the one song. And they'd be like, again, again. So we sang the same song because we wrote one song together. Okay. And it was just like we sang it and then we did like, da-na-na-na-na-na, like with our, you know. And it was like, oh, it was a protest song.
Really?
Yeah, it was like, should I do it?
Yeah, sure.
It went, fire burning hot as hell, da-na-na-na-na-na-na, hearing people screams and yells, da-na-na-na-na, and we don't have no rights, da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na, this talk of war is getting round, da-na-na-na-na-na-na, people living underground, da-na-na-na-na, but we don't have no rights, da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-
I mean, were you feeling like you didn't have any rights?
No.
But no, we grew up.
I know. Well, we grew up, I realized that my, well, of course, our parents are all like.
Right, hippie.
We're
activist
hippie activists. Yes, they weren't right. Like, you know, smoking. They weren't like doobie smoking like West Coast hippies. These were like,
yes.
My father was like, you know, a Black Panther. I mean, he was a lot of things, but he was Black Panther for a while. My mother, like our parents were serious.
Yes.
Activists,
yeah.
Is what I will say.
Yeah.
They were the part of the, they were in like the awakening movement of the 60s.
Wow. And that actually, and I see that, that it shows through in the work that you did. Like, I know there is, and I'm not sure which one comes first with the Afro-punk movement that you were, because you were a front woman for a couple of the bands, but for Suffragette. Yes. And I was... What is that behind the suffragette? Isn't that, does that have something to do with this women's rights movement?
It should.
Oh, okay.
But really what's strange is that in suffragette, I was like giving everything away. I mean, I literally had been like, suffragette was, it was so weirdly controlled by the guys in my band and the men in my life in the music business.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fine. I was like, here, do it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, when I listen back to it, like I was really in like lyrics. I mean, I wrote all the lyrics, you know?
Wow.
And some of them I wrote with my guitar player, with my, manager,
mm-hmm.
like we kind of were a writing team, but some of them I wrote all myself. It was a really intense time and a woman. A lot of the songs are just about heartbreak and like getting wasted.
Mm-hmm,
and but it's very strong. I mean, I'm really like, I remember my mom came and heard that music and she was like, oh, like you sound a little bit like Janis Joplin, but not in a good way.
Right,
she
right,
knew
right.
She had witnessed Janis Joplin being very drunk in film in San Francisco and ultimately killing herself.
Right.
So I think that. So that was a really intense time, but it was named after the suffragettes, but it had all these double meanings because we spelled it J-E-T-T, like Joan Jett.
Right, that's what, yeah.
In like an homage to like a modern suffragette.
Okay.
It's so intellectual that it almost like made it annoying because you know, people were like, what?
What? Yeah, what is
suffragette? So I'd have to be like, suffragette, S-U-F-R-A-G-J-E-T, I don't know, what, how do you spell it? J-E-T-T, like, it was like, realizing how hard I was making it.
Yeah.
And plus, I was the only woman in the band.
So it wasn't even,
it was three guys, like, fronting, like, you know, supporting me.
Right.
But, yeah, it had a lot of meanings, so...
Was that part of like the Afro punk scene?
That was part of the Afro punk scene. But then that was my immersion out of the Afro punk scene and into the Chicago punk rock, like metal scene.
Okay. Because there was somewhere where I read Mountain Motown. It was that.
That was
later, or
that was a later period.
But so you moved from this to a more Chicago. How is that different?
Well, Suffragette came out of. I had a band called Simi that was,
cool.
Just called my name, and we were making Those were a lot of the shows we did with like Tamar Colley and a lot of the women who were in the who were like we started as a collective of black women in the West in the East Village playing rock and punk music, which we felt was totally normal.
Right.
But it was very it wasn't normal for the record labels.
Right.
And we wanted to, you know, do our thing, and we just fell in love with each other. Myself, Tamar Colley, Maya, and our friend Honeychild, Caroline Coleman, and we ended up doing shows together where we would share bills and do, and it became the Sister Girl Riots.
Wow.
And Tamar Colley was doing; she was much more advanced than I was.
Okay,
I came from kind of like, no, I don't know. Like I was more hippied out in a way.
Okay,
I wasn't in my even though I was writing, even though I was born of activists. I kind of I don't know. Like as I got older, I just wanted to. I didn't realize I stepped away from being political.
Okay,
not on purpose, but just did.
Yeah,
you know, I feel like I. But I ended up being around people that really had those kind of voices, and I loved those kind of people. So I was able to be part of this movement. And I was exercising my right, but I was so young, you know. I was, you know, I was like 20 years old or 21. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's
like,
young.
And I, we were all pretty young, but we, so in a way, like, I didn't realize how effective, how, for one thing, how unique it was that we were fronting rock bands.
Right.
And as a black girl, I just never thought it was a big deal.
Yeah.
I was so surprised at all the, like, glass ceilings.
The resistance to even just the concept of
Yeah,
it.
Not from the people that came to hear
like
us.
The
I mean,
fans
we
and
sold
stuff,
out
right?
CBGBs. I mean, we were, you know, we were really good band.
Yeah.
And those guys were amazing, but like we just weren't getting signed.
Wow.
And after a while, like, and so then, and then we did Sister Girl Riots, and that was the, we did a few of those shows, and then everybody kind of like, I think it got. You know, we were like in on this progression, and then something just wasn't happening. And I, now, when I think back, I feel like we just weren't getting like that support from the industry, or like, you know what I mean, like the dough. Someone to, you know, like because when you're selling out, you know, music halls and music hall, and you have all these kids coming to see you play, and all these, you know, where do you? I mean, I guess you keep playing, but. It's hard. I think, I don't know, everyone just kind of dispersed. Like, Maya got married, and I think Honeychild started going on the road in Europe, and Tamar Colley got more into, like, her sound design and that kind of thing. And I got into more of, like, I got into a different, I kind of, like, went more towards Radiohead, like, mainstream. I think I was I was really into, like, white dude indie rock.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of music I wanted to make.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't think, like, well, I'm a black girl.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, this is the music I want to make.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was very confusing for people.
Yeah.
And I was, so yeah, so we did that. And then we made a great record. And then a couple band members, you know, we had some problems with the band because it was always like we were always almost we were really intertwined with the music industry. You know what I mean? Like I got really thrown into the music industry. I think not, when I wasn't yet evolved totally as a musical artist.
Okay.
I mean, I was, but within myself, I didn't have a clear vision, and it was so much information coming at me about how I was supposed to be, how I was supposed to act, like, and then I was kind of getting a modeling job sometimes, and like, I just would get these jobs,
right?
And I just didn't, I never, I'm telling you, I was like, whatever, man.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll be the model in this. Yeah, what? Okay, let's do this. And then, right. Like, it was a very weird period. And then I think people started thinking, like, I was a model that was, like, that was in a band.
Yeah.
Which I was, like, too bad I don't have, like, all the money in the bank.
Right.
Or the jobs at a model. I don't know. Like, it just was weird. Because I think I was, like, a good-looking young woman.
Oh, you are.
And
I still are. You're a beautiful woman.
Well,
I mean, unbelievably beautiful.
Well, thank you.
But you have a beautiful heart and soul, too.
I did a
which is very rare.
Well, I must admit that I thought people thought I was pretty, but I really honestly didn't think that I thought I was okay looking.
Right,
I thought like,
right.
Okay, I'd be like, okay, Leah, like today I look nice tonight.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Like honestly.
Yeah, and the power that you can have, but having the power as a beautiful woman, young woman, is also like dynamite because there's this need for powers to be or a certain group in the industry to manipulate that and to use it
and I was I didn't have the wherewithal to know like to use what I had,
right?
You know, I just
yes.
was like I was kind of this hippie, you know. I had issues with my hair.
Mm-hmm.
I was like one of five, you know, mixed girls in school.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I didn't feel like the pretty girl. And I didn't care anyway, because I was raised like very spiritual and within Woodstock, where people were really against being judgmental.
Right, like, right.
You were cool if your parents were away for the weekend and you had a bottle of vodka.
Ah,
you
interesting.
Know what I'm saying?
Yeah, sure.
It wasn't
do.
A lot of like you don't have money
right.
or you're ugly or that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like you were cool if you could drink.
Yeah. No, listen, that's a small town thing, though. I mean, even growing up in Little Rock, and I look at all the smaller towns like Pine Bluff, and that became the thing with young people, you know, is that it was about, you know, having the house, parents gone, or being able to go to a football field and, you know, guzzle, I don't know, I just never did that, you know, but still, I had a lot of friends who did.
Yeah.
You know, so wow, that so now what
okay.
I wanted
yeah,
to
I don't wanna, and I just wanted to say like I really don't want that to come off like conceited or something that I'm
oh no not
about
at all
my looks
no listen I was looking at some pictures of myself the other day. I was going I was looking good.
Yeah, you don't realize,
but but now that I'm older, I look at it, I go, God, I was attractive. But now I look at myself and I go, you know. But you don't think about it at the time. You don't,
no,
you know, people tell you.
Well, I think it, in a way, like, I didn't know that maybe that was, I tell you, my ex-boyfriend came to see me play with the New Pornographers.
Oh, that was one I wanted to get into, too.
Yeah.
The other group that you fronted, New Pornographers.
Well,
that's an interesting name.
Yeah, that was a great period of time. And, the New Pornographers. So I left Suffragette, and I that band imploded. We were huge partiers. We made great rock music, and we put on crazy shows. We were really doing it. We were living life. We were on the road for 5 years in a van.
Wow.
And we were, you know, kind of like dirty and like, you know.
Yeah, the whole kind of typical.
But we were. It wasn't like it was. Ugly, kind of.
Oh, okay.
It was. I mean, no. I mean, it was dark. It wasn't like we weren't putting on a front. I mean, we were fucking crazy a little bit. We didn't even realize how crazy we were until later. Like, oops. But
when leaving from the suffrage or whatever suffrage.
Yeah. So we left Suffragette
to New Pornographers.
Yes. Yeah, so when I came back to Woodstock, like shortly after I met you, and I was I started getting back into I started working with Natalie Merchant.
Okay.
And I did Dear Governor Cuomo. with her.
Okay.
And started doing these activist things. And we started doing shows for women's domestic violence and raising all this money and raising awareness for, like, for issues that concern the people and human rights. And I was like, I love doing this. Mm-hmm. And then we did Ladies of the Valley, and then I did my own Ladies of the Valley show, which was, Natalie's like, now you know the blueprint and you can do it yourself.
Okay, that's when, okay. Yeah.
So it was like, so I was doing all these fundraisers. Mm-hmm. That's was just, I was like fundraiser girl. I was just doing like, you know, fundraiser for the school, fundraisers this, they were calling me. I was like, yeah, I'll do it. And then I ended up doing a fundraiser with the singer from the New Pornographers, Carl, who's, and Nico Case, and a couple, and you know, it's a big band, and Nico Case couldn't tour, and Carl called me out of nowhere and was like, can you fill in for Nico for this tour? And I said, sure. And I went on tour with them, and it was a tour bus. We were like in a tour bus in America.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. Yeah. I was like, oh my God, I'm on a tour bus in America. Mm-hmm. This is the dream.
Yeah.
This is the dream.
Yeah.
And it was amazing.
Yeah.
And we were playing these huge shows, and we played Pitchfork, and we played to like 7,000 people in Michigan, but Carl kept being like, this is not normal for us, Simi. Like, we don't usually play to this many people, but, and I was, and then the next show would be like Pitchfork, and I'm like, really? Because every show.
Right.
It was just one of those, like, that tour in particular was really, like, massive.
Yeah, yeah.
Audiences.
Yeah.
And, so, and we were on a tour bus, and it was amazing, and they were, I loved them, and they were, we just, it was a miracle, it was like a miracle, because I'd been through so much shit with the industry, and with my band, and with, you know, partying, and and then I was chanting then, you know, that was after I had started chanting, and that was like one of the things that came, and so then I was working with them, and I worked with them until 2019, until the pandemic.
Ah, okay. Now, I know in 2019, there was a song called Beautiful One that you just re-released.
I did. I remixed it.
Yeah, you remixed it. And I've read about kind of what you say the song's about, but I'd like for you to just kind of share with us what, because the lyrics are just really beautiful and profound. And
so, thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, that song is like, I feel like it has another life in it. Like, it's going to find its way because it's been so helpful for people. Mm-hmm. Like, people have been like, I play that song 30 times in a row. And that's like, that's what I do with songs that like are helping me. Yeah. You know, that's kind of crazy, but.
No, no, it's true. That's what music does.
Yeah.
It soothes and it supports and it encourages. I mean, that's so, what it should do.
Yeah. My friend, Rain Phoenix, who, you know, she's part of a well-known, like, artistic, and actors are in her family, you know, and, but we were friends when I was a lot younger, and then we reconnected, and she, during COVID especially, and she was like, I love that song, Beautiful, and I can't stop listening to it. Would you do a remix of it?
Wow.
And I said, yeah, maybe I'll just do the remix. So I did the remix myself.
Wow,
like,
okay.
On my garage band.
Yeah, yes, okay.
So, and, you know, it didn't come out exactly the way I wanted to, but I thought it was really interesting to have to reintroduce a song. And then I remixed the video, too. It's not a new video, but it was kind of this remix of the whole thing and remaster. And the song, but, it, you know, the lyrics stayed the same. And it's basically about it's about, like, it really came out of a huge heartbreak that I had that was very devastating. And I think it was because it was the first heartbreak I ever went through without, because I had quit. I was straight edge. And I didn't use any substances to, like, get through it. Or like, I wasn't smoking. I stopped drinking. I stopped doing everything. So I just was feeling all these feelings of abandonment and loss that I had never, that I had always, you know, been self-medicating. Because the relationship was a beautiful relationship, but it was a three-year relationship with, like, a younger artist guy. And And he's lovely and amazing, but it kind of didn't match how upset, how crushed I was with. So that whole album, The Beautiful One Is On, kind of came out of that.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of like you're singing your the manifestation of what you want things to be. And so that song was like an imagining of coming back together.
Okay.
And also just about wanting to be free to express myself, you know, because it had been so long, especially as a musician, to be able, and an artist, and like even as a person, just to be able to to be free, just to be who you want to be. Everyone says that you're supposed to be who you want to be, but when you're not doing it, and then you get a feeling for it, it's like, oh, okay, this is real. And it was after really crushing heartbreak then that song came out, and it was like, it was a beautiful song.
Yeah, it's
and
beautiful.
Don't know what I want to be, what I want to do, what I think, what I want to be someday, but I want to be free. I want to be free. Don't know what I want to be, what I want to do, what I think, what I want to be someday. It's a beautiful night. You're a beautiful one. So it was kind of like, it was just like what those magical nights when you just are with somebody and they're so, it's like this such a special little, you know, moment in time.
Yeah.
And love and freedom and just not knowing knowing what that feeling is and not really knowing how to get it. But you know what it feels like.
So was this the time when you started painting more?
Yes. Okay. This is exactly the time.
And that's, we're getting around to the visual artistry your life, which is...
Well, this is exactly the time that I was, that's when I was writing that song. That's when I was drawing. Yeah. I started making paintings for the first time with the pastel paintings. And so that was almost, maybe that was like a song to myself. That when I think back now, it's like me saying like, you're beautiful, like I love you too, you know?
Yeah.
Because I needed to see, during that period, I mean, there's a lot of searching in that record, a lot of searching, there's heartbreak, there's like a searching aspect to the songs and a wanting of that's something that's realistic, you know, but a beautiful life kind of.
Right, right.
Which we know as Buddhists is not
going
in private jets and blah, 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 right, but it's like that freedom of spirit.
Because when I look at your earlier paintings, a lot of self-portraits.
Right, and they're not exact.
Maybe not self-portraits, but I think, I don't know, how
well,
would
you know,
them?
I really was pushed against that, but when I look back on it, it is, because they all are, you know, brown girls, and they are living, if you look at them, they're a little bit crooked.
Yeah.
And so that was part of, like, some people were like, oh, you couldn't fit her in. And I was like, no, I actually drew the face.
Yeah.
I would draw the faces first and then the body. So it was kind of like you're disconnected from yourself. You're trying to fit into this box.
Square.
So then I started pushing that even more. So like almost like
having
the head chopped off, you know. You're like, it's very disturbing. But they were these kind of, you know, brown Nubian beauties. I don't think of them as myself, but they had like kind of a body that I always had wished, which was more voluptuous than my body was, because I always had kind of like a boy. I felt like my body was more like utilitarian, like a boy.
Yeah,
like
it's
I didn't have a lot of curves. I just felt like I was my boyfriend and I wore the same jeans, you know? It's disconnected from what was going on. But anyway, I felt like, I don't even need to wear a shirt. But like, you
that's
know that?
That's so not true. That is so not true.
But.
Oh my goodness, Simi.
No, I know. But I'm just saying, like, I look at some of the clothes I would wear mm-hmm. and just, yeah, I mean, I see girls that were, when they were 20, 23, with like, you know, they have like wearing no nothing.
Oh yeah, please. Those little cut off tops and.
But the paintings, those earlier paintings, there's, you know, they're women and they're in nature and they're mm-hmm. beautiful.
Yes.
And they have full bush. Mm-hmm. Like.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I felt like I was in a very controlling relationship for a long time where there was a lot of like control over my body and having mm-hmm. to shave and mm-hmm. I don't like, and I was like, oh, okay.
Well, yeah. Whatever you want, I'll do it.
Yeah. Like I don't really like curly hair mm-hmm. and I don't really like pubic hair at all. Like well, you better, I don't know if you can put that on the air, but
yeah, you can put anything.
That was, I think when I think back to those, because literally that was the point of those paintings. Were those women's?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and that's why that
big ass bush.
Yeah. You know? No, it's definitely there. You can see it.
And sometimes I would put a dress over it, but
yeah,
you could still see.
But it
see.
Was always there. Kind of was. Yeah, interesting.
And I wanted it to be. I don't know. Those were like out of the body experiences. Mm-hmm. Why I was doing these like bushes. I didn't plan. Like I'm gonna draw women with really big bushy bushes. But I felt like I'm gonna draw beautiful. Creature, they were like, wow, these beautiful creatures mm-hmm. in the woods with these bushes.
Yeah.
That are like so beautiful.
Right, absolutely.
And I guess it's so funny because when I was doing it, mm-hmm. I just felt like, and I did that art show.
Yes.
And my mother was like,
she was like,
my mother's Jewish, and she had a word for the
bush.
What's the word for it? I forget. I wish I remember it, but it was like, oh my God, you're gonna do the girls with their. She was just like Ike Vault, you know, like totally Ike Vaulting. But it's kind of like it was like this thing where I would like be. It was the horror of life, and I would go into it and look at it.
Yeah.
And I would be thinking I'm gonna draw a picture of pain.
Yeah.
But what would come was not.
Wow.
I kind of go into like this
mad
frenzy and draw these shapes and like, and women and blah, blah. And then I'd look back and it would be like the woods.
Yeah. Wow.
Because it was like the woods up here were, after I got like my heart ripped out, I felt like it mm-hmm. smashed to pieces.
Yeah.
And plus he was like a tall, good looking white, mm-hmm. man mm-hmm. from Connecticut mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and he left me for like a white girl mm-hmm. I'm just being honest.
No, listen,
like, and I think that I was like, it was like I really was questioning.
Oh yeah.
I really was at a loss. And mm-hmm. it was like right when the people from the church got the boy from the white boy went to the church in North Carolina
and killed
those kids.
Those
creatures. Killed those kids.
Yeah,
there was a lot of that all coming mm-hmm. at me. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like, I guess I ended up finding myself.
Yeah.
Because I was like, I'm either going to destroy myself, mm-hmm. which I thought I was going to destroy myself mm-hmm. just with a broken heart or a broken self-esteem. Mm-hmm. But then all these women, they saved my life. I mean, that drawing saved my yeah. life. And so really that record goes with those
yeah.
paintings
yeah.
because they were all made at the same time.
Yeah.
And when I had the show, we played the record on repeat.
Oh, yeah.
But, and it wasn't out yet.
Yeah.
And people were like, well, who is this? Oh my God, who is this?
Yeah,
I need
yeah,
to,
yeah.
the time, you know, but I was like, oh, it's going to be our record. And then whatever that ended up. That record ended up, I put it out myself, so it ended up kind of, it got lost mm-hmm. in the shuffle.
Okay.
But, yeah, so that those earlier paintings, yeah, they, and sometimes I feel like I want to go back to that.
Now with you, because I have looked at your work since then. And
yeah, what do you think?
You continually evolve. You said, it was in a quote, and you say, this is what you talk about your songs, and you say, my songs tend to reflect the conditions of being alive. The feelings come first, then the words. Human beings fascinate me. how to find peace, how to hold on to yourself. Love, despair, and healing inspire me. Ultimately, I want to make people feel joyful from the music, healed by the music. And that quote that you said seems to apply to not just your music, but also your art, you know, and what you were just explaining about the art and the way we purge these things that are deep within us. And, you know, this show is actually about what scares you. And so it's always going to be, you know, we always have these fears that we carry around. Am I enough? Or am I this? Or, you know, and all those are tangled in. But what's so great about being an artist is that we have canvases, so to speak, or we have ways in which we can express these things and dig really deep and pull out if we really are sincere. And you always give that to me. I always feel there's a purity in everything that you do. And so you dig deep, and when you pull out, you have now, you know, purged and purified things. And so you see it in this kind of brilliant light of complete, total vulnerability and honesty. And we don't see that a lot in music. You don't see it a lot in music. You don't see it a lot in art. You know, everything's kind of around, I don't know, whatever. You know, I don't want to sound like an old person. Well, you know, it used to be this way back in the day. You know, I don't want to place myself in that. But I know that from what I have observed and experience of your work, your music, your life, you know, I feel that. I feel that and I get that. And it, to me, it's like a jewel, a rare jewel. And so so I do think your new work is even more evolutionary because we talk, too. You and I talk,
yeah,
and we know what's going on.
You can't stop talking.
Yeah. I know. We were worried about this particular episode. It was like Simi saying, I'm going to give myself about 3 hours.
Yeah.
Right, because it will be like a three-hour-long thing. I'll just do it in parts if I have to do it in parts. But yeah, I think your work is really definitely reflects your sincere journey of self-discovery. And I think that you also openly accept that you do change, that people can change, you know? I mean, and you're fine with it. You have that whole free spirit of Woodstock in you still. And I think that's what protects you, is having that open, free, I'm not gonna like, you know, we always look at our, in this Buddhist practice, we look at ourselves first, right, about what's happening. We don't say, oh, it's them. We always look at, okay, there's a problem. I need to look at myself first.
Which has been such a gift, ultimately, in, like, being able to get through things. I'm not saying it's easy, but, you know, when you come into fear or abandonment or, like, you know, especially in the business and getting left behind, or, you know, even early issues with my father and everything, you know, you want to blame, you get, you know, you want to go through these things. And when that stuff comes up and you find yourself, oh, I'm blaming, I'm this, you know, and then you can go to, you know, you take it to the practice and you go back to you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately you're freeing yourself of whatever's muddying your trip out here.
Yeah.
Because, and that's been such a gift. And our friendship has been such a gift too, because,
yeah, I feel that way too.
Yeah.
So, but what I'd like to do right now is I'd like to take you metaphorically into the basement, which is the subconscious.
Okay.
So I usually, at this part of the segment, I ask three questions.
Okay.
And the first question is, what is the scariest subject in any medium, like, say, painting, photograph, book, movie, television show, a radio broadcast, dreams, real life, you know, outside of music, that you've encountered?
The scariest subject?
Yeah.
Outside of music?
Well, yeah, it could be outside of music. It could be inside of music. But I think, like, you know, more outside of the music. Like, some people talk about a movie that scares them or a book they read or, you know, politics or whatever it might be that would be kind, like, of a subject.
That would scare me to that just actually terrifies me?
Yeah, it's just like, wow, this scares me. This is scary.
Ultimately, you know, my mom not being here anymore.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
That's one of the most terrifying thoughts that I
Yeah, that could come that up I across. Have. Yeah. Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, Mom, going to 104.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
She's like, okay, I'll try. I will. She's very healthy, but I guess death. No, I'm not. Yeah, that. I mean, to be honest, like, yeah. I mean, I have a lot of other things that I think sex, mm-hmm. actual sex, mm-hmm. Is an intense subject to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Which dying and having, you know, that's all kind of very connected
and related.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. absolutely.
And death. Death of loved ones.
Mm-hmm. Someone that's very close to you.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, death. And yeah, it's like, I get like, oh my God, I should go spend all the time I can with my uncle.
Right.
Like, I need to call my uncle every day.
Right,
like,
right.
I should go live with him. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I just get into this fucking, and I literally get like frozen. And when you say afraid, you know, mm-hmm. That's when I think, I'm like, well, what terrifies me?
Yeah.
That. And I think it's always like being left.
Yeah.
Abandoned.
Yeah, abandoned.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's a huge thing. That's big for me. And I wrote that song, Take Me With You, about my father when he was dying. Because mm-hmm. I was basically like, can I come?
Yeah. Yeah.
You could see how people are like, fuck this. I'm not going to be here without. Like.
Right, right, right.
I was like, wait, don't go. Like, yeah. It was fucking horrible.
Wow.
So. Yeah, I think
that's the thing.
Yeah, people leaving, I guess, mm-hmm. but like really leaving, and the terror, the horror of losing someone, mm-hmm. like, you know, even talking about it is just like making me like want to pass out.
Yeah, well,
so
we're going to go to the second question,
okay.
So you don't have to go to that, which will make it a lot more fun.
Okay, so, sorry to get so serious.
No,
I don't know what other people say.
No,
but
no, this is great.
Swimming.
This is great.
Swimming with sharks.
Having someone
hate snakes and worms.
Or it's like having someone accidentally put milk in my coffee when I'm allergic to it.
Yeah.
That could be something like that too. But
I'm like, go straight to the jugular.
You go deep. You go deep. So, okay. So the second question, tell us about someone you have worked with in the industry, right? Who was a little frightening to you, but in a good way.
Who should I pick? Frightening. I mean, I guess when I first met Nat, but I was a little bit starstruck and like nervous when I met her, but I wasn't afraid. Like, she didn't. I mean, that she was a huge person.
Yeah.
Because we just connected like right away, mm-hmm. and then she kind of saw what I had to offer, and we did the putting on the show. So I think Natalie Merchant has been a huge person like that in mm-hmm. my life. But
yeah.
I mean, I was intimidated.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but she was like, no, sing on this. And then she was like, sing on my record.
Yeah.
Sing on
yeah.
this. Let's yeah. do shows together. We mm-hmm. worked together for a long time.
Yeah.
And so she's definitely someone.
Yeah.
That's
actually a great example.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's a good way. And there's the intimidation. Several people who have been on the show, it's been that kind of thing. Another artist that they ended up touring with or they had to play with, and they really respected them, but it was kind of like, you know, that.
I really respected mm-hmm. her, and I was almost like, oh my God, she believes in me.
Yeah.
Am I good?
Yeah.
Am I any good? Like, she really thinks I'm good.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Oh my God. I better be really good. You know what I mean?
Right,
like,
right, right.
She wants me to sing on her record.
Right.
Oh my God! What if I sound horrible? You know what I mean?
Right.
No, I just we're cool being cool, but I, you know, like,
yeah. No, it is. That's definitely a great example. So now I'm going to ask you the last question.
Okay.
What is the scariest thing that has ever happened to you while performing live?
Oh, wow. I was never afraid for my life on stage, except a little bit after the Paris terrorist attack, where they started shooting at the band.
Wow.
Because we were on tour during that time.
Wow.
And I remember being like, are we going to get like a little bit of like looking out in the in the audience, like, oh my God, is there a shooter in the audience?
Right. Wow.
Like, you know, I had this feeling sometimes, like, am I going to die? I know when I was the most afraid.
What?
I was on tour with David Byrne, and we were in Brazil, and they had just killed a girl, a mixed girl that had the same hair, everything, like me and one of the and the other girl in the show, Angie, who's a guitar player, and we were playing in Brazil, and we were staying in a hotel, and we were like kind of, we had to, when we went from one place to the other, and we had like armed guards.
Wow.
Who like drove us. Or they were like armed guards at the door. Like we had to be like protected, especially because they were killing lookalikes.
Wow.
And I remember we were at the show, and Angie and I were talking, and I was like, dude, are we like, we're fucking like in Brazil, and they just killed that woman, and like we're singing about like, every show we were singing the Janelle Monáe song at the end, say her name, say his name. And we were naming, and we would go every city we were in, we'd find out who had been killed by the authorities or someone. And that we were going to say her name.
Wow.
And I literally was in there, and I was like, oh my God, like, are our lives in danger? And Angie, because Angie said something to me, I was like, I don't know, like kind of. We looked just like her.
Right.
I mean, the hotel people were like, don't go walking out
alone. Exactly, right. Wow.
And I asked David Byrne, I knocked on his dressing room door or wherever, like, and I just said, you know, can I talk to you for a second? And I said, do you feel like we're, like we could be in danger because of what, we're saying and what's going on in this part of this country. And he was like, yeah, I mean, he's like, how much is activism, like, how much is it, like, this is what it takes.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. You are risking your life.
Yeah,
yeah. He basically was like, yep.
Yeah.
So that show, we played, I mean, I prayed before. Hand. And I was like, okay, if I get killed in the show, like, I'm doing it for the right reasons. But I have to admit that I was like,
yeah, that's
what if I get shot?
Yeah, no, that's definitely so. Yeah, that's a great story. Wow, it's scary too, because I would never like imagine that part of it. But that's it.
Okay.
All right. So thank you for doing the show.
Thank you, Veronica.
We finally got this to do this together. We've been working, hitting and missing, you know.
Yeah.
But I do appreciate it, and I appreciate your honesty and everything. And
oh.
It's a great show. It's a great show, I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me to be part of it and to be on, you know, to sit here and listen to me. And I'm just so blessed.
Ah. Thank you. Okay. So that wraps it up for us on Tales from the Jazz Side.
Bye.
The Jazz Side is always there, waiting for us to enter and waiting to enter us. So, until next time, unplug your ear holes, for you never know what worlds may be waiting for you.